Welcome to Shift with CJ. I'm your host CJ, and together we will explore the areas of health, human performance, biohacking, psychology, and much more that will inspire you to become the best version of yourself.
In the real world, what matters most is like adherence to the diet. If you are someone who is able to like control all the calories and weigh all the food and be mindful of those things, then in that case it doesn't yet matter that much which kind of food you eat.
A leading voice in longevity, biohacking, and health optimization. As an 8-time best-selling author and anthropologist
with over 208,000 YouTube subscribers, shares cutting-edge insights on how to optimize health, performance, and longevity. See you, man.
Longevity is a super cool topic. I have been interested in longevity ever since I was a kid. Thing where I'm not scared of death, but I'm always trying to optimize for in any shape or form to enhance longevity.
These metabolic ward studies where people are actually controlled for their entire food intake, like they literally eat a certain amount of food, then the calorie deficit always is the biggest determinant of weight loss. And regardless if it's a low carb diet or a high carb diet.
In your book, you talk about the J-shaped curve of exercise.
Yeah, so exercise obviously is beneficial for health and it has a lot of health benefits. Like it's the only thing that pretty much we know will reduce your risk of chronic diseases and keeps you healthy for longer and keeps you youthful for longer. With moderate intensity exercise, it's pretty much as you can do, the better it is.
Hello and welcome everyone to this special episode of the Shift with CJ podcast. I'm here in the studio after a very long time and for a good reason, because today I have a very, very, very special guest. My guest on the show today has done multiple things. I mean, I have been following him since 2016. He's wrote over 9 books. He's best-selling author. This guy is terrific on stage, terrific off stage, and he's been called the prodigy of biohacking. Everyone, please welcome Seem Lan. Seem, welcome to the show.
Yes, I'm happy to be here.
I'm so happy that you're here with us, and especially you're in Dubai. Guys, Seem doesn't live here. He lives in Estonia, and he does biohacking meetups and workshops, and he's on stages in Europe and UK and US. So thank you. We should feel very lucky that you're here today.
Happy to be here.
You have written a new book, which is called The Longevity Leap. Now, you've written 9 books. So, when you were growing up, did you like writing?
Well, actually, not that much. Well, at least like not in high school. I wasn't keen on like reading classical literature or writing essays or something. It was not something I was like super interested in. But during university, I did started to like it for some reason. And studying anthropology, most of your like exams and tests are, you know, essays or something, not like a question and answer kind of tests. They're more like, you know, literature-esque tests. And I was pretty good at it. That I figured out that I was able to write essays quite fast, and I was able to research these topics also quite fast, and it kind of grew onto me. And during the last year of my university, I did start like my blog, which was back then centered around just self-experimentation, health optimization, and biohacking, and all those different kind of topics, which then grew to my YouTube channel. And over the course of now I've been doing it for 7-8 years, the YouTube channel, and it's kind of always evolved and kept getting better. Like right now, I think my content is 10 times better than it was in the beginning. Maybe you can remember as well. But
I think your content back in the day was superb as well, because I remember that time I was on this all serious ketogenic diet, and you were posting a lot about keto and macros and micros and carb cycling. And I was like, okay, perfect. You were one of the biggest sources that I would go on to.
Right. Yeah. Well, it has obviously evolved a lot, and I'm covering nowadays mostly about longevity and health. So it's always been what I'm interested in and what I'm doing myself, the content that I create. And right now I've evolved into caring most about longevity and lifespan.
Longevity is a super cool topic. I mean, I have been interested in longevity ever since I was a kid, So a lot of people in my close circles were, I'm like the black sheep of the family, so I'm the only one who's healthy. Like, I'm interested in the healthy stuff, right. And everyone else are like, you're just wasting your time. But those guys are also the ones who died really early. So I always had this, you know, thing where I'm not scared of death, but I'm always trying to optimize for, in any shape or form, to enhance longevity. Mm. Years later, like this was like 3 years ago, I was speaking to a tarot card reader, and she was like, do you even know the meaning of your name? I didn't even reflect on it till then. So my name is Chiranjeev, which literally in Sanskrit translates to longevity, or like a blessing for, I was like, wow, I'm perfect, makes sense. But anyway, I want to talk about your book. But I want to do this a little bit differently because, you know, of course, you've been on like thousands of podcasts. Most of the times we're talking about like deep, deep science. But I feel like these days people are having such short attention spans that most of the times we talk about things. And for you and me, we can go on for hours. But most of the times people look into the science and then they're just like doze off. In fact, like one of my colleagues, he was telling me, I was asking him to do some TikTok research, and he was telling me like, hey, CJ, you know what's trending on TikTok right now? I was like, no. He's like, the video is split into two screens, and there's like someone talking about something, and there's like a Minecraft game going in the bottom. And I was like, oh, right. We really don't have any attention. Like, you know, yeah. ADHD hyper. So you, obviously, my friend, are in great shape. I want to talk to you about a few things that a lot of people have been asking me. And, you know, since 2016 or even before that, these topics keep on coming up. So let's go through them one by one and we can like get your opinion on it. Mm. You can tell us what is underrated, what is overrated, what is some of the latest things right. that you have seen that is working. First thing that I want to talk to you about is fat loss. Mm. You're in great shape. I know you work out very well and you've optimized your life. But for a person who is trying to lose body fat or body weight, where do you start? Like, what do you think has the most amount of ROI? What is plain bullshit? Like,
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, any diet can result in fat loss and weight loss, and you can build muscle as well on pretty much any diet with a few key criteria. For fat loss specifically, the biggest one is energy deficit, which can be triggering for some people, or they might disagree with it. But you know, if you look at these metabolic ward studies where people are actually controlled for their entire food intake, like they literally eat a certain amount of food, then the calorie deficit always is the biggest determinant of weight loss, and regardless if it's a low carb diet or a high carb diet. So you know, in the real world, it's obviously can be different, because if you're living in a society without like people controlling you and controlling your movements, then of course you're going to have cravings, you're going to have opportunistic food, let's say environment where you're, you know, you see a bagel, you're going to eat the bagel, or whatever the case is, like someone brings you donuts at the work. You know, there's always these kind of situations in the free world that can be, you know, disruptive or harmful to fat loss. So in the real world, what matters most is like adherence to the diet, which means that, are you able to stick to the diet? Are you able to stick to a lower calorie intake? Are you able to not feel so hungry that you're going to overeat? And are you able to do it for the long term? So that's the like the biggest factor for fat loss in the real free living world. And there are some diets that obviously help to achieve that more easily, and others less so. So for less hunger, more satiety, more energy, then you generally do better on a whole foods diet, you know, that prioritizes protein, healthy fats, healthy carbs, fiber and vegetables. You're just going to feel very satiated and full by doing that. And, you know, they also like stimulate all these different kind of peptides in the gut that promote satiety, like GLP-1 and those things. So like olive oil and fibers and protein, they all increase GLP-1 expression. That makes you more satiated and you end up eating less food for the entire day. If you are someone who, you know, is able to like control all the calories and weigh all the food and be mindful of those things, then in that case, it doesn't yet matter that much which kind of food you eat. Like, you could theoretically lose weight on a Twinkie diet, which has been shown to be possible. And you could likewise lose weight on a Whole Foods diet, as long as the calories and the macros are equal. And there's also some nuances here that affect the calorie balance, such as the macronutrients, like a higher protein intake. So protein has the highest thermic effect of food, which means that you burn the most calories digesting protein. So if your diet is very high in protein, you're already like automatically losing certain amount of calories for digesting that protein. And because you're not eating, let's say, fats and carbs in replace of that, you'll be in a calorie deficit as a result of that. But it's still like calories in versus calories out, because the protein makes you're not absorbing all the calories in the protein, because some of those calories are wasted on the digestion of that protein, if that makes sense. From a dietary perspective, generally whole food and high protein diet is the best one. Mm-hmm. And from exercise standpoint, then with exercise, it's better to do some form of resistance training plus cardiovascular exercise for the general health benefits. You don't need to do exercise specifically to lose weight, mm-hmm. as long as you're in a calorie deficit, but it helps to create the calorie deficit. And if done right, then it also improves metabolic health and reduces satiety and cravings overall if you, let's say, do the right type of exercise.
Hmm. You mentioned craving, and this is very interesting because people can have, we know that willpower degrades as the day passes by. The more you use, the more you lose. It's also, some people also say it's a muscle, so you can strengthen it. But ideally, somewhere around the afternoonish is when people start feeling their cravings. Like, they start in the morning, there's enough glucose in the brain, and they can make better decisions, and then cravings come in. Are there any new, you mentioned protein, just to recap for the audience, protein is really good, fiber is really good. There's also added benefits of the fiber acting in your gut, making things like butyrate or, all of these short chain fatty acids, which will also help you feel satiated to a bit. But is there any other trick or a hack that you've seen that people, the moment they're feeling cravings, they can, is there one pill that can, apart from all the GLP-1?
Right. There are some supplements that could also increase GLP-1 and support weight loss, like berberine. Mm-hmm. So there are actually quite a lot of randomized controlled trials where berberine, somewhere 500 to 1500 milligrams a day, helps with weight loss. And reducing waist circumference. And one of the mechanisms is that it increases GLP-1. It's, of course, not nearly as effective as Ozempic or something. Mm-hmm. But it's, if you're not super clinically obese, then berberine could help with that to a certain mm-hmm. extent. And it also has antibacterial effects, so it can help to fight endotoxin and the bad mm-hmm. bacteria in the gut. So that's one option. Another option might be more controversial, which is diet beverages or diet soda. Mm-hmm. So there are actually randomized controlled trials where people who drink diet soda lose more weight than people who drink water. Which contradicts all the ideas that diet sodas make you gain weight and make you increase insulin that prevents fat loss and makes you diabetic. When you look at the actual randomized controlled trials, then people who consume diet beverages or are told to consume diet beverages, then they end up losing more weight than those who are drinking water. And maybe part of the reasons is because it's kind of a tastes sweet, it kind of tastes like a treat, and you probably end up eating something else, you end up eating less something else that is sweet later. So if you're craving for sugar, you drink the Diet Coke, you're not going to eat the donut or the bagel. At least that's for what could happen for some people. There's also probably some people who it's the opposite, that they drink the diet soda and they end up craving more mm-hmm. of the donuts and they end up eating the donut. I guess it's very individual of the what the response might be, but there's nothing, let's say, objectively in the diet beverage that would make you gain weight or mm-hmm. prevent the fat loss. If anything, then it could help to curb the cravings. Mm-hmm. Because at the end of the day, it's the calorie deficit, and if you're not eating anything, then you end up losing more weight, so to say. With water, water can also help with that. If sometimes you might be dehydrated, I think like sparkling water is a very good hack as well to reduce cravings and hunger, mm-hmm. because it's tastier than regular water. Maybe the carbon dioxide may also have some pro-metabolic effects, but it certainly helps with like hunger and cravings to a certain extent. Maybe squeeze a bit of lemon or some electrolytes in there or something like that. You can make it flavored as well. But sometimes regular sparkling water can help.
Like out of my personal experience, every time I feel, not like craving, but like I know that I'm getting hungry, every time I have sparkling water, it completely, at least for the next hour, it diminishes it. And I also like what you said about the lemon and some salt, so you get some electrolytes in. And sometimes it's hydration, sometimes, you know, the mineral balance is completely low, and because of that, our cells are not able to perform the duties that they're usually doing, and giving them a little bit of extra support works. And it's super interesting about this diet soda thing, because I haven't heard about this before, but now when I reflect back, I know a lot of people who are watching their calories, but they will always, like, I have very close people, they will not enter a restaurant unless and until they can have diet, they choose their brand, either Diet Coke or Diet Pepsi, whichever fan they are of. But with every meal, they have to have it. And usually, I see that they're the ones who naturally go to this 80%. They will never go to 100%. They'll have their meal. They'll have their Diet Pepsi, which is a non-negotiable. And seems to look like they have much more control of their appetite. So there could be something fantastic. You mentioned berberine as well. Berberine also, I mean... It also works with, in your book, you talk about comparing berberine with metformin, which is, let's call it a diabetes drug, or like something that can, a glucose disposal agent, pharmaceutical, which is very powerful. Have you experimented with metformin? Because I know a lot of people now that they're like, okay, you know what? We read it in a pod, or we saw it in a podcast. We'll do 1/4 of the dose of metformin. Mm. Do you have any experiences of using those?
I have. Taken it for some time, not right now, but yeah, I mean, the research about metformin is quite interesting. It's certainly very beneficial for people who have diabetes or insulin resistance, and reduces risk of heart disease and cancer in diabetics. So it's literally life-saving for diabetics. For in the longevity space, it's always also associated with reduced mortality in non-diabetics. Mostly from like a past study that found that non-diabetics who didn't take metformin had worse mortality risk than the diabetics who were taking metformin, which would be very, let's say, contradictory in the sense that diabetes, you know, increases your mortality risk, and non-diabetics saw a higher mortality risk than the diabetics who were taking metformin. So it would be that metformin somehow completely negates the negative effects of diabetes and also improves your mortality chances compared to not even having diabetes. But that study was with a few flaws, and the reanalysis of that, whether it was done, I think, one to two years ago, they found that it's not the case, that diabetes is still bad and metformin isn't going to be better than not having diabetes. So with that being said, I think that metformin, yeah, if you have even, you know, maybe not even full-blown diabetes, but if you have slightly impaired glucose metabolism, you're like pre-diabetic or even not even there, you know, just have like not the best metabolic health, it can be for sure like a net positive. It's certainly more powerful than berberine in improving blood sugar levels. Berberine is better at cholesterol and lipid lowering effects than metformin, but metformin is better than at the blood sugar lowering effects. So I think metformin is useful for people, yeah, if you, and even then, like, you're a healthy person, you might, okay, I'm gonna eat birthday cake or whatever. You can, you could, yeah, like, hack it with metformin and take the metformin, which is better than, I guess, I mean, yeah, if you're a healthy person, then even eating regular birthday cake every once in a while isn't a bad thing in the long term. Like, if you do it once, then
yeah, you're able to manage your glucose.
Yeah, it's just going to be, yeah, it's not going to have any long-term negative effects on your health. But you could theoretically biohack it with taking metformin.
Have you experimented with dihydroberberine?
Yes.
And what do you think, like, berberine versus dihydroberberine? In your because the studies show us it's 4 times more powerful, but in your personal experience, did you feel much of a difference?
I didn't use, like, a CGM to see, like, how it would compare to regular berberine. But, I mean, let's say it is like more powerful than berberine, but it's also more expensive, so to say. So
it's not available everywhere. It's difficult to find it.
I think, you know, regular berberine already gets the job done if you're just a healthy person who wants to improve slightly with fat loss or blood sugar levels or lipids, for example. And if you're diabetic, then you'll be better off by taking metformin anyway.
Okay. Good.
Although berberine can be done together with metformin with beneficial effects.
Interesting. Okay, perfect. I think a lot of people, I am requesting you guys, if you're listening to this podcast, if you're watching this podcast, take some notes, rewind, listen to it again, and you know these things are gold. Now let's move on to the second biggest problem that we see, especially in a city like Dubai, which is sleep deprivation. Sleep deprivation because people are not able to shut off their mind. Sleep deprivation because people have poor lifestyle choices, which makes them sleep voluntarily late at night. And yeah, some people have just their sleep-wake cycles are a little bit messed up. Some days they're working in the morning, some days they're working in the evening. So what do you have to say about sleep? Because I know you're... Back in the years, I've seen like your Oura Ring scores, and like I've seen 99 or 100 many times as well. So, how do you hack your sleep?
Yeah, sleep is very important. I think that you know you should still have like exercise and the diet and everything else on point, because you know sleep only is going to enhance your recovery from exercise, but it's not innately going to make you healthy. Mm-hmm. Like if you sleep even like 9 hours per night, let's say you're getting plenty of sleep, it only like maintains your health, but it's not going to like, you know, improve your metabolic health in of itself without the addition of exercise. It's not going to make you build muscle without exercise. It's not going to make you
lose weight
without exercise. But if you are sleep deprived, then it's going to make it very much harder to lose weight and especially lose fat. You're more prone to lose muscle in a calorie deficit if you're sleep deprived at the same time. Yeah, with sleep, the biggest problems in the modern world are like psychological reasons, you know, stress, anxiety, or just rumination. Environmental reasons, mostly like light, maybe EMF, maybe noise, traffic noise, all those things. And a third would be like dietary components as well. So eating too late, eating foods that increase your heart rate, make you pee in the night, or something else like that. So you know, you do need to like pay attention to all of them. You know, with the easiest things are the environment. You can just use blue blocking glasses. You can use a sleep mask. You can put filters on your smartphones so you're not going to get the blue light in your eyes before bed. That would inhibit melatonin production and increase your alertness. And you could also like change like light bulbs in your house or dim down the lights. Those are like very effective ways to preserve your melatonin. And for the noise, yeah, like earplugs or noise cancelling headphones or something like that. For the food, it's also relatively easy. I believe that having a slightly earlier dinner tends to improve sleep more than eating too close to bed. So I've, you know, tried different eating windows. I've eaten 1 hour before bed, I've eaten 4 hours before bed, 5 hours before bed, and generally I sleep the best if my dinner is something like, you know, five hours before bed.
5 hours, okay.
Yeah, I usually have like dinner at 4 p.m., finished by 5 p.m., and then I have 4.5 hours before I go to bed. And the food choices, you know, as long as it's not something super heavy, it should be, you know, fine. Generally, like very, very processed foods, very salty foods, spicy. Fried foods, they tend to be worse for the sleep, and some healthy proteins. And I do think that healthy carbs are also very beneficial for sleep. So you have tryptophan, which is one of the amino acids you get from protein, that gets converted to serotonin, and that serotonin gets converted to melatonin. But the issue is that if you just only eat, let's say, protein, then you're getting all these other amino acids as well that compete with tryptophan's entry into the brain. So you're not getting the serotonin boost from just protein alone, unless you're getting like also a lot of sunlight exposure and during the daytime, etc. But one way to kind of circumvent that is to eat carbohydrates with the protein.
Sorry to cut you, but like then there's always this question, okay, someone told me to eat carbs, and now this is my free pass of eating carbs. Right. Ideally, do you have a ratio of carb to protein, or is just like make sense of like whatever you're doing that day and use?
Yeah, it depends on the person and their requirements. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I can eat several hundred grams of carbs a day and be very fine. For someone else, it can be a recipe for high blood sugar and other issues. So it depends a lot on their particular metabolic health and situation. So yeah, I don't think there's any like one size fits all macros for everyone. I do think that protein is pretty much the same for everyone. So if you're getting something like 1.6 grams per kilogram per kilogram of protein per day, then that already like maximizes muscle growth effects, and it, you know, you get satiety and all the nutrients you would need from that amount of protein as well. So you don't need like massive amounts of protein, and everything else, fats and carbs, is kind of whichever you prefer. Mm-hmm. So there's no like specific amount of carbs your body needs. With fats, you do need a certain amount, but it's not like a high amount of fat. Mm-hmm. So if you're getting 50 to 70 grams of fat per day, then that's already covering all the essential functions that your body needs. So I prefer that kind of approach, mm-hmm. that I take my protein, take my fats, and everything else comes sort of from carbs for me. Someone else, it might be, you know, different. Mm-hmm. But yeah, going back to the carbs, then eating the carbs, you know, it's not, you don't have to have like a massive amount, just a regular amount of carbohydrates, like a sweet potato, a banana. Kiwis before bed actually have been shown to improve sleep. So like two kiwis, they're very good for sleep. And just some healthy fruits or something like that. That's mm-hmm. more than enough to help with tryptophan getting into the brain to help with the sleep.
What about supplements? Any favorites?
Yeah, I mean, for sleep, melatonin is very well researched and proven to work for sleep latency and sleep duration. And interestingly, there was like a recent meta-analysis of several clinical trials where they saw that the optimal way to take melatonin for the sleep was 4 milligrams 3 hours before bed. Mm-hmm. Although they did compare it only to like a 2 milligram dose 30 minutes before bed. Maybe smaller doses would be, you know, better or something else. But yeah, it makes sense if you take 4 milligrams 3 hours before bed. So by the time you're already going to bed, you have higher levels of melatonin. Because if your melatonin supplementation can shift your circadian rhythms in either direction. So if you take it too early, then you're shifting your circadian rhythm earlier. Mm-hmm. If you take it too late, like immediately before bed, then you're actually shifting your circadian rhythm later. So yeah, probably not the best idea to take it only like immediately before bed. Probably better to take it
a few hours before bed.
Because then you're already kind of tired from that melatonin when you go to bed.
What about, have you tried experimenting with high-dose melatonins, like 100 mg, 200 mg?
I haven't tried 100 milligrams. I've tried like 10 milligrams. Research is quite interesting that this 10 milligrams is shown to have anti-inflammatory effects, also lowers lipids and improves metabolic health. It didn't feel, you know, maybe there's some adaptation period. I didn't feel like very, you know, energized in the mornings because of that.
Very groggy, right?
Yeah, always felt like a melatonin hangover a little bit.
Melatonin hangover.
Yeah. I haven't tried 100 milligrams.
Yeah.
I have found that on Amazon there are like pills with 100 milligrams mm-hmm. Supplements, but I haven't found them in Europe. So, you know, maybe if I'm in the US, I'll try it out. Mm.
But it's also strange to look at supplements because I think there have been like so many different examinations of different supplements, and they show that in certain categories like melatonin, you could either be getting like a 20 to 40% higher melatonin or lower melatonin based on like different brands, correct?
Yeah. Yeah. It can be something like up to 470% more
470%, that's crazy.
Yeah, but I mean, let's say you get like 1 milligram pill.
0.3 or, yeah.
Yeah, so it's 470%, it's 4.7 milligrams. Mm. So it's very small amounts though.
So interesting, like one thing that went in my head while you were talking about this is also the idea of calories in versus calories out, right? CECO. We know that it is one of the most important factors, like you mentioned, but also the modern ways of estimating calories or these the ratios that are online. So if anyone who's listening, there are different kind of like Harris-Benedict ratio and all these other ratios where people can go in, they can type in their age, how active they are, what kind of things they have, and then it'll give you like an estimated calorie ratio or like calorie intake for maintenance, for growth, for fat loss. But just a good thing to highlight, like sometimes, and I want to know your views on this, if we read a protein bar is like 200 calories, then most likely it's not 200 calories. There is some sort of, I think it's like 15 to 20%. It could be above or below.
Mm.
And also when you look at life as a general thing, all of these small percentages, they add up. And also they say now that sometimes you look at like, for the average person who's on a cardio machine, they're on a Seber machine and they estimate that they're burning X amount of calories. And then they're looking at their diet. So just like the point I want to bring forward is like also look at it from a flexibility point. Like not everything is grain in stone and there can be some calculations which are, so listen to your body mostly. But like, yeah, I would love to know
your opinion. Yeah, for sure. Like it's not a perfect method. And I guess the main idea isn't so much that there is a specific number that your body has. It's true, your body doesn't have a calorie meter, so to say, but there is an energy balance. Mm-hmm. So, and calories are just a way to assess, kind of predict that energy content and predict the energy balance of your body. So that energy balance can be completely different from the whatever the numbers the calculators say or the food has, but the point is that there is an energy balance. Mm-hmm. After which, and you know, many things affect that energy balance. Hormones, time of day, sleep,
toxins,
excess. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of thyroid function, you know, those things influence the energy balance, but there is an energy balance. Mm-hmm. So to say, we don't have a perfect way to measure that energy balance, and there are some, you know, exceptions to the rule, but usually those exceptions aren't like permanent. You know, if you starve yourself for, let's say, 7 days, you're on very low calorie diet, and you start eating again, it feels like you could eat everything and you're not gaining weight.
Hmm.
Because it's a very kind of, I guess, like a very extreme scenario where your body, it becomes very inefficient at absorbing the nutrients as well. You're actually not like, you know, storing the weight. But it's a short-term adaptation. If you do that, if you eat like 10,000 calories for 3 months, you're going to eventually start gaining the weight back. And you're, you know, it's just an example that there's, you know, it's very adaptive system, obviously, but there is like an energy balance. That energy balance fluctuates a lot. We don't have a perfect way to assess that. But if you are, let's say, another extreme example is, you know, bodybuilders.
Mm-hmm.
They're the leanest people in the world, and they're also the most meticulous with the diet. And they always, you know, they pretty much if you want to get to Olympia, Mr. Olympia stage, you know, you're competing with everyone who is counting calories and counting macros. And the one who is getting the leanest generally, you know, of course, there's a lot of things as well, steroids and hormones that affect that. But generally, you know, they all count calories very meticulously. They are preparing very hard for that role and they're also the leanest.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're taking like an extreme example, then, you know, calories matter for them. Yep. 100%.
I remember seeing this old school Ronnie Coleman videos where he used to wake up at like 4 a.m. or like 3:30 a.m. and he's like,
right,
I've got to complete my one meal, so I have to just wake up and eat this one meal. And like,
yeah,
of course we were kids back then, but it was interesting to see like what kind of dedication and passion these guys have.
Right.
Now let's, you spoke about something interesting, which was exercise. So let's move on to exercise. In your book, you talk about the J-shaped curve of exercise.
Mm.
And you also have certain numbers of like, okay, you know what, 900 minutes per week of maybe just light walking, yoga, things like that. And then a few minutes for high intensity. First, let's just start off with like the J-shaped curve of exercise.
Mm.
And then you can build on there for like longevity and muscle gain and all of that.
Yeah, so exercise obviously is beneficial for health, and it has a lot of health benefits. Like it's the only thing that pretty much we know will reduce your risk of chronic diseases and extend health span specifically. You know, the evidence of maximum lifespan is somewhat more limited, but it certainly keeps you healthy for longer and keeps you youthful for longer. So you're able to do your everyday activities that tend to decline with age. So you're able to carry your groceries, you know, lift things, run around. If you exercise, you're able to do it for much longer. Granted, you're not getting injured at some point. But yeah, like too much exercise can be, of course, harmful. It's like this positive stressor that if you're not doing enough or not at all, then you're experiencing increased harm. If you're doing too much, then you're also experiencing increased harm. So the sweet spot is somewhere like, you know, moderate amounts of exercise. And there's quite a lot of research about this topic. It's, again, it's hard to make any definite conclusions about that because many studies, they're not standardized in the way to like measure these things. They don't standardize with resistance training, for example. They don't standardize the intensities and how much time you rest between sets, how many sets and reps you do. They only look at, okay, how many minutes per week do you do resistance training? So it's not a perfect, let's say, conclusion, but you know, theoretically still excess exercise, excess resistance training, excess interval training, excess cardio, all of it can be harmful.
Let's talk about what do you do, because I think you've figured for sure you've figured 99% of it out, so we can like learn from what you're doing every day. Mm.
Yeah, I can share what my interpretation and conclusions based on the literature I've read is. And one thing that, yeah, really changed my mind about it a lot was a 2023 review that looked at all the major studies done over the last 5-6 years on exercise. And they came to the conclusion that with moderate intensity exercise, it's pretty much as you can do, the better it is. Mm-hmm. So it was like a linear association with reduced mortality and reduced heart disease. So, you know, 100 minutes per week of moderate intensity exercise, which is 40 to 60% of your max heart rate, that's better than zero, but 900 minutes was better than 100 minutes. So it's like a linear association. You know, they didn't look beyond that. Maybe at some point, maybe if you do 2000 minutes, maybe it's going to be harmful, but at least 900 minutes per week is still beneficial. And I'm trying to, yeah, like add more of this moderate intensity exercise rather than only doing high intensity exercise.
Give us an example of this moderate.
Moderate intensity is like, so 40 to 60% of your max heart rate. And it depends a lot on your age. If you're older, then that's lower heart rate. For me, I'm 30. So for me, it's something between the range of like 90 to 115 beats per minute heart rate. So this is like a light jog. It can be light jog, light cycling, hiking, speed walking, you know,
zone
stretching
two?
Some sort of animal flow mobility exercises. Yeah, zone two is like 60 to 70%.
Okay, sorry.
So it can be that, but it has to be slightly lower intensity. So yeah, like just light movement. And I just, you know, go for walks generally every day, do some...
How long are you walking? Because in the book you said that, correct me if I'm wrong, you said that people who walk 8,000 steps versus 16,000 steps... 16,000 steps has a 5% decrease in all-cause mortality.
No, it's so that compared to people who walk 2,000 steps a day, who walk 8,700 steps a day have 60% lower all-cause mortality and 51% lower heart disease. But going from 8,700 to 16,000 provides an additional 5%.
Okay.
So those who walk 16,000 have 65% lower mortality risk compared to those who walk 2,000. So you want to get at least, you know, the majority of the benefits come from going to like 8,000, 9,000 steps. If you double that, then you get only 5% extra.
How much are you walking?
I walk usually something like maybe 10,000. Mm-hmm. So I'm not like going aggro for the 16,000. Yeah. I'm going, yeah, like... 9,000, 10,000, 12,000, something in that range. So I'm walking, I'm doing, go for a forest walk or hiking or something like that, that's nice. I do like light cardio quite a lot every week, maybe 2 hours per week of this zone two on the 60% of heart rate. That's pretty much it. With high intensity exercise or vigorous exercise, which is 70 and above percent or 60 and above, they found 60% of your max heart rate and above, they found that there was a, first of all, it provided less risk reduction than moderate intensity exercise. So it's still, to a certain point, provided a reduction in the risk of mortality and heart disease. But at some point, it became like a J-shaped curve that if you do it too much, mostly like, I don't recall exactly, but for heart disease, it was if it was above 240 minutes or 300 minutes, somewhere in that range, then it started to provide, it like reversed the course, that it started to increase the risk. And my takeaway from that is that, yes, doing zero high-intensity exercise is bad, but if you do too much, if you do like over 4 hours, 5 hours per week, then it might be more harmful in the long term. So I'm trying to kind of achieve this sweet spot somewhere in the like range of like 250 minutes of vigorous intensity exercise. So that's interval training and resistance training. So what I'm doing is I'm doing 3 times a week, I'm lifting weights, which totals in about like 180 minutes per week. Mm-hmm. And then I'm doing interval training as well for 30 minutes, maybe twice a week. So that will put me in the range of like 240, 250 minutes per week of vigorous intensity exercise.
What's your training split like? Because like ever since I've known you or, you know, seen you multiple times in different conferences, your body shape, like I remember when you were in London, you were super lean. And then maybe we met in the US or somewhere we met. And then you were like super buff, like which was also not like the buff that everyone imagines with a little bit of fat, but like super chiseled, but like super buff, and like now you're in great shape. So what, like over the years, how has your training split or training styles changed? Are you doing more of bodybuilding? Are you implementing some CrossFit or one like, you know, one set to failure, or what's your current training look like?
Yeah I like strength, so like powerlifting style. I'm not like interested in getting massive in with muscle mass, but I am interested in increasing like lifts on the main compound lifts, like squat, deadlift, and bench, and those kind of things. So I'm kind of focusing on those most of the time. And yeah, the reps are gonna be something like 5 to 6 reps per set. That's what I've found works very nice for me. And three sets of five, for example, is a working set usually for one exercise. And I do, you know, calisthenics obviously as well. I like calisthenics. I might do some, yeah, like kettlebells. Like I use kettlebells for mostly like some high intensity intervals or some circuit training or something like that. But I like to kind of keep them slightly separate. So I don't like smashing all things together, that doing cardio with weights. I don't like to do them together. If I'm doing cardio, then I'm doing the cardio. If I'm doing weights, then I'm focusing on the strength. And I'm not even trying to even like get super exhausted with the weights. I'm focusing on the strength and power with those exercises. And with interval training, then I am trying to actually increase my heart rate high.
Interesting. Okay, so I think we've got enough on the exercise piece. Thank you. Let's jump on to longevity. Here, I want you to give us like your top, now you've written a book and you've written multiple books and you speak to experts all over the world. Give us like your 3 to 5 top tips for longevity. Like you can just list them out, or like we can go one by one and you can think about it. And then we can just dive into those top 3 or top 5.
Yeah, I think first would be to kind of be deliberate about it in a sense that, you know, track things and see where your health is at. Longevity is very kind of complicated, and we don't have like a perfect understanding about it. And there's always like some people live long despite smoking and despite drinking alcohol and living a very like non-healthy lifestyle.
The Blue Zones, Jens Clement.
Everyone knows like a grandpa who smoked and lived to 100, right? But at the same time, there's also like millions of grandpas who smoke and, you know, don't make it past 70. So it's you shouldn't look at these exceptions to the rule, because they're like, you know, there's probably something else that's going on genetically that enabled them to live so long. So we don't have like a perfect understanding of, okay, why do these people live so long? But what we do know is that, okay, there are certain chronic diseases that kill most people in their 70s and 80s, like heart disease and cancer and neurodegeneration. So you just want to focus on reducing your risk of those diseases. And the way you do that is by, you know, of course, you can follow what the evidence says about healthy lifestyle, diet, exercise, etc. But how do you know that you're still not heading in the wrong direction? You know that by looking at your blood work and looking at what's inside your body with different tests and scans. So I think that's a very, you know, crucial component of longevity for mortals without excellent genetics. So you look at your, you know, blood pressure, lipids, blood sugar, all these different blood markers that, you know, typically get worse with age, and at certain ranges are associated with diabetes or kidney disease or something like that. If you could see that your blood sugar is, you know, creeping up, then you know, you can fix your lifestyle. You can, you know, take berberine, metformin, or change your diet, whatever it looks, weight. They all
exercise.
Will. Yeah, they will kind of. Some people might need like a wake up call that. You know, usually the wake up call happens when they get diagnosed with diabetes, unfortunately, which isn't too late. Like, there are a certain percentage of people who do get whatever chronic disease and still make it to 100, but it's much smaller percentage compared to those who, you know, avoid these chronic diseases and make it to 100. So the best thing is to avoid these chronic diseases by tracking your blood work and adjusting your lifestyle according to the results of that. The second tip would be to like invest into your physical reserve, cognitive reserve, and social reserve. So we know that poor muscle mass and muscle strength and frailty, they are predictors of increased mortality later in life. And the older you get, the harder it is to maintain those things. So you need to build like a reserve. You need to build, when it's relatively easy, even in your 50s, it's quite easy to still build muscle compared to if you're 80. So you need to build a reserve of you know, physical density, like muscle mass and strength and bone density, as well as, you know, cardiorespiratory fitness as well, that you have a good cardio system. You can build that reserve earlier in life so that when you're 80, you're not falling behind, which puts you at a much higher increased risk of premature death. And the same with your cognition. There's a thing called cognitive reserve and brain reserve, which refers to your brain's ability to counteract this age-related decline in cognitive function. So things like education, learning new languages, new experiences, socializing, healthy diet, those lifelong cognitive work, those things maintain your cognitive function and build this cognitive reserve that it doesn't completely protect against neurodegeneration, but it does reduce the symptoms of cognitive decline later in life. And the last one is also the social reserve. So loneliness increases with age. The older you get, the more likely you are to be alone. And one of the biggest predictors of longevity is social relationships and happiness and you know, feeling good about yourself and others. And you know, yeah, if you don't have that, you know, social reserve, then again, it's first of all, you might not have the desire to live that long, and second of all, it's also a big predictor of chronic diseases and mortality. Even something like, you know, you're 80 years old, you fall, there's no one else to call the ambulance for whatever help you need, and you know, that you're gonna have worse outcome compared to, you have someone in your house, like a spouse or child or grandchild, who can call the ambulance and get you the help you need. That can be like life-saving if you're 80 years old, for example. So building up your social reserve, physical reserve, and cognitive reserve. And it has to start, you know, early. You build it throughout your life. And the last tip would be, I think not being too attached to this. So like, you shouldn't let your longevity routines be a bigger stressor than whatever you're trying to avoid. So if you're very neurotic and stressed out about your exercise and diet and supplements, like, oh, there's a, like, air pollution or seed oils or artificial sweeteners, like, if you have like a very fearful mindset about the world, then chances are it's going to cause more stress. I think it also just means that you might not have the confidence in your own body's ability to be resilient. And
it might also like you're just more vulnerable to all these things. Whereas if you're, you know, confident and healthy about your ability to bounce back from whatever unhealthy thing you're doing, then it becomes a more harmful thing.
I love the last point because I think, you know, there are multiple books written on it, like The Biology Belief by Bruce Lipton. We in the traditional Indian and the yogic sciences culture have been talking about this for the year, like thousands and thousands of years, that every word, every action, every thought that you are having or you're saying, it's not just the person that is around us listening to it, it's also your cells. So the more you keep being fearful and the more you keep saying, oh, see, this might wreck my sleep, or today I missed the workout and I'm not going to be as strong tomorrow, your body's just going to be like, and there are trillions of cells, they're just going to be like, okay, perfect.
Mm.
These are our instructions. Let's follow what you're saying.
Right.
And then it's like a vicious cycle, right? Like you do that, you get a little bit of dopamine, and then it happens again and again. And someone says, oh yeah, like if you have friends which are also saying, oh yeah, we're not going to do it because, you know, we might just miss our steps or my rings for today. And then it just creates that fearful thing. Longevity right. is something that a lot of people are doing so they can add quality to their life, and, you know, quality in terms of the years, in terms of their movement, in terms of their relationship. So anything that you will do at this point to destroy that quality, I think you should like think about it. And thank you so much for pointing that out. And I mean, like, I can talk to you for like hours and hours, but that's a lot of things for people to digest. So we'll let people digest it, and then you're here next time. We can ask people what questions they specifically had and then build from there. What's next for you? So you're building all the, like, you are, like, if someone had to ask me, like, oh, you're interviewing Seem, like, who is this guy? I'm like, think about biohacking, longevity, and wellness. It's like a trained AI ChatGPT kind of a mind. Like, you can ask him anything, and he's just going to be, like, able to tell you, like, the latest and the greatest. So ChatGPT 4.0 or whatever is the updated one. So... What's next for you?
My new book, The Longevity, came out last year. I am working on like another one. It's about supplements, so I'm gonna make like a supplement bible to just
Perfect.
Cover what the evidence says about different supplements. I'm also I'm organizing like some retreats in India, maybe in the future in Dubai as well. It's like a health retreat for diagnostics and treatments. And other than that, I'm actively just posting on YouTube and Instagram.
Thank you for educating us. I want to thank you on behalf of the rest of the world, because I know the kind of content you have and the kind of lives that you have inspired. You've certainly been an inspiration for me. Like, I remember long time ago, like, I think you were talking about when you left university, or like when you were in university, you took a year to read like 300 books or 200 books or something like around that number.
Right.
And I was like, man, that's what I should do. And I was like, right. You know, so I mean, like, reading and all of these things. And guys, come on, like, we're going back. We're in 2025. We're talking 2015, 16, 17, so like 9 years maybe. Mm. But yeah, you've been inspiring me for that time. I really appreciate that. And I'm sure like thousands of other people. Now, what I want to check with you is imagine, if you can go back to your younger self, you have this time, you take the time machine principle or whatever, you go back to your younger self, you can peek back and say, hi, little Sim, or like, maybe Sim last year. Here's one piece of advice. What advice would you give yourself?
For general life or
anything?
Health.
You can even say, oh, buy crypto.
Right. I think one thing is to take shortcuts in your life to not have to go through all those things yourself. So it's better to learn from someone else or from others, which I have done throughout the life, but I would like do that more. Learn from others more to shortcut your learning curve. I guess
that's amazing, because I guess at the end of the day there are only two paths. One is a longer path, which has a lot of hurdles. You might get hurt, you might never make it, and you might spend an entire life and you might get like a little bit closer. And then there's the other part, which is, I guess, more of the biohacking mindset. Listen to people who have walked that path. Listen to people who are already there, but like you're 20 years behind them. They can mentor you. They can coach you. And one concept that I also like is like actually paying for education. Like, for example, like if I wanted to, if you're listening to this podcast and you feel inspired, like I would, if I was you, the first thing I would do is like, okay, perfect. Can I, you know, take a Zoom call with Seem? I don't know if you consult people or not, but can I just pay to get whatever this person has experienced with all of your polyphasic sleeping? I remember you did that. That was a bit crazy. But the idea is, you know, go out there and try to make your life easier. And the only way you can make your life easier is to avoid the things that you will get into doing anyway. So there's a slow route, there's the fast route. You guys decide. And Seem, thank you so much for joining me. Where can people find you? Where can people buy the book?
Yeah, so my website is seemland.co. I'm Seemland on YouTube and Instagram. And yeah, the book is on Amazon, The Longevity Leap.
Cool. I will put all these in the show links. And you guys will be able to access it. His Instagram and YouTube is off the charts, so I highly recommend it. And this is me, CJ, your host, signing out of the Shift with CJ podcast. Everyone, have a great day, have a great week, and actually, have a great lifetime. God bless everyone. Thank you, sir. Your time and presence with us through this podcast is highly appreciated. If you want to learn more, then head over to our website, www.shiftwithcj.com.